Y'all, y'all.
Man, love that new intro. Love the new theme song. Welcome to the first brand new format episode that we're calling Weast World. Man, where everything is possible and nothing can go
wrong.
Hey, there's my man Mike Abbott on guitar. Man. Yeah, Mike. Get it.
Yeah, why don't you leave me alone, man? It's hard to play and talk, you know, at the same time.
Sorry. So Mike kind of sounds like Miles Davis when he speaks. It's weird. Hey, we have a guest today in the leadology tradition. A leadology guest, as it were. It's the mighty Steve Turay. I've had the privilege of knowing Steve Turay for quite a while now, and he's one of our greats in the trombone world, in jazz in general. The music that we call jazz, for lack of a better term, right there in the midst of it is Steve Turay. Trombonist, writer, composer, arranger, and sea shellist. He plays the conch shells as well. So there's an entire body of work to get into with Steve, so we're gonna have to dive right on in. I think in some upcoming episodes of Weast World, we're gonna get into a lot of different things. Comedy, you know, politics? Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. But we'll get into a lot of stuff. But this one is going to be the Steve Turay Show. Hey, in the background, that's my man, Eduardo Bijou Barbosa. Woof. Great bass player. All right, man. Well, you know what? Let's get on to it then, because we got a lot to cover with the one, the only, the legendary, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Steve Turay. Hey, folks, look who's here. It's Steve Turay, my good friend. Man, listen to that audience. That's crazy. We need some kind of security or something. Hey, settle down. It must be a lot of Shell fans out there or something. I don't know. All right, the audience settles down. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. You know, keeping busy. We got the big week. Big week this week. SNL got a 50 years anniversary specials Friday night. We're at Radio City.
Wow.
For all the musical guests. It's a big concert celebrating 50 years of music. And all
beautiful
people that have played on the show. And then Sunday, we got a 3-hour, not Saturday as usual, but Sunday's is a 3-hour primetime special on NBC from May till 11.
Wow.
Celebrating 50 years of SNL.
Man, all right. So for folks that are listening, and I'll have this up today, we're talking, let me look at the thing here. So the 14th, the Valentine music special, is that on or that's when you guys are recording it?
No, it's live.
It's live.
It's a concert.
Okay.
But I think they must going to be recording it because they got all kind of TV cameras there and everything. We had a rehearsal yesterday.
Wow. And then 16th, the Sunday, is the big primetime live show.
The TV, yeah.
Man, everybody tune in. This is, you know, every time a trombonist gets on National Hookup Live TV, an angel gets its wings, man. So,
man, I tell you, you know what? I was just thinking, it's 50 years for the show. But I have been there 40 years, man.
Wow.
Yeah, wow, man.
85. That's an amazing run. That's like being on Duke's Band or something. That's just like a lifetime.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, man, so much to get into, as everybody who listens to this will know. I mean, your body of work is profound and, here's something to start with. I have made it my business to be around you whenever I could, especially when I'm spending somebody else's money. So I had you come out to a university a couple of times, just to be around you. I like to surround myself with people of your status, and there's not many. So, but I've noticed one thing, and I was showing some students once a video, an old video. Remember the Verve video? It was Carnegie Hall, I think, and it was the Carnegie Hall Jazz Band, or it was you and Slide and John and all the cats and Roy. And Vanessa Williams introduced you as Steve Touré. So what is your favorite? What's your favorite pronunciation? What's the official pronoun? I always say Touré, but...
Well, E is in Latin languages. E is pronounced like A. I is pronounced like E. So if people say Touré, Touré, no, that's wrong. That would be T-U-R-R-I.
Right, right.
T-U-R-R-E is Touré. Touré. Like the number two, and like Ray Charles.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So your preference is the emphasis on the two a little bit, not as much as maybe as Vanessa did, but...
Kind of equal for me, Touré.
Touré. That's how I've always said it. Well, you know, my name gets Weist and Worst and West and all. It's pronounced Weist, so... And it's a German spelling, so I'm real.
I kind of like sensitive. Yeah, I kind of like the accent on the last syllable. That's how Rassans used to say it when he'd introduce me to Ray.
Touré.
Yeah, that kind of has a ring to it. I might like to go with that.
That's nice. That's where I've always headed that way myself with the Touré. That sounds like hooray.
Yeah, I like.
Hooray for Touré. That's what I'm thinking. All right, so I got to stick to the book here, or we're just gonna have a fun time jabbering. I mean, I'll speak for myself, but let's talk about Steve Begins. So you begin in the Bay Area in San Francisco, of course, and what are maybe just some musical influences at a young age, how you chose trombone, maybe some of that.
It was by happenstance, chance. I grew up in a suburb of Oakland called Lafayette, California, and when I was a kid, it was nothing but about three blocks, small town, three blocks with a gas station, a hamburger stand, a little food store, a liquor store, of course.
I think I cut you off. It was Lafayette. Was that the name of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So
what's going on there? How did you get into music and trombone in general?
Downtown. And they had good, you know, California, like most states at that time, had good instrumental music programs, even in grade schools.
Right.
Now, it's a rarity unless you get to some of the richer suburbs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a good beginning band. My older brother played in the band, so I wanted to play too.
Right. What did he play?
He played saxophone.
Oh, okay.
And I went to the band room, and the guy said, no, you got to be in the fourth grade. Come back when you're in the fourth grade. So I came back in the fourth grade, and he said, okay, what instrument do you play? And I said, well, I don't know. I just want to play in the band.
Right, right.
And so he had two big posters up on the wall, and one of them was the orchestra instruments, and you know, they had the snare drum and the timpani and the bass drum and the cymbals and the woodwinds and the flute and the oboe and all that, you know, and all the string family and all the brass family. And then on the other poster, they had a marching band. And the front row was about five trombones, you know, because of the sound. For some reason, I looked at it and I said, I want to play that. He said, that's a trombone. I said, okay, I want to play that. Wow. He said, okay, good. We need trombones. Everybody always needs trombones.
Isn't that true? Yep.
So my mom took me to the music store, and they rented a trombone. And since I was there and the guy happened to be in, she gave me a lesson, the first lesson, so I know how to put the horn together and hold it and stuff, you know. And he taught me a little song that first day. I was able to remember it. I'd pretend to be looking at the notes, but I couldn't tell what those things meant. Yeah. I was playing it by ear, but it was called Sweet Sue, Just You. Ha. And it said, bo-do-do-do-do, bo-do-do-do-do, dee-do.
Nice.
Soo-do. You know that little song.
Yeah.
And I went home, I was so excited, I went home and played it for my mom, and you know, and then I played in a school band, and in the fifth grade, still in grade school, my parents took me to see Duke Ellington, because they were big band people.
Wow.
My mom and dad met at a Count Basie dance.
Wow, how about that?
And so they were big band people, that was their music growing up.
Yeah.
So they took me to see Duke Ellington in person, Ella Fitzgerald guest vocalist, Woo! Coleman Hawkins guest soloist.
Damn.
Clark Terry was in the band. Britt Woodman was playing first trombone.
Yeah.
Johnny Hodges.
Eventually record with him, man. That's so cool.
Yeah. Man, I didn't know what they're doing. I was a kid, but I said, man, I want to do that. I want to play that music, man.
Wow.
And that started me on my journey.
Man, what an incredibly auspicious start, man. That's as good as it gets. Well, it's okay. So you're developing, and then once again, most folks listening to this that already know your background would know that one of the first guys you hook up with is the great Ray Charles. Just another auspicious thing to happen. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, before I went out with Ray, I was living in the Bay Area, but it's kind of a convoluted story, but I'll tell you if you're interested.
Yes, please.
Well, I played in I first started playing jazz, what we call jazz, in middle school, junior high, they used to call it. They had a good jazz band. And that's when I first started improvising in the New Orleans style, kind of like we learned the Saints Go Marching In, and later on I learned Muskrat Ramble and Bourbon Street Parade, and those kind of songs.
Right.
And, you know, it was fun. I really enjoyed it. I knew in middle school that this is what I want to do. I want to play music. Something about it just rang in my core, you know. I said, this is what I want to do. I didn't know how or why. I just knew I wanted to do it. It wasn't because I wanted to be famous or get the girls or any of that kind of stuff.
Right.
Get rich playing the trombone.
That's a tough one.
No. I don't know. But, you know, I just wanted to play this music, and so I continued. And in high school, it's funny, in high school I played, of course, in the jazz band and in the concert band, but the rules were you couldn't play in the jazz band and in the concert band unless you played in marching band. And I hated marching band. To me, it's so unmusical. You got to play loud as you can, marching, and it's banging your lip, and you can't get a good sound. It's military music. It's for fight, you know. And so the only way I could get at marching band was by playing football. So I played on the football team.
Really? I did not know that.
Yes.
Wow. What was your position? What did you do?
I was a wide receiver.
Oh, of course.
And anyway, you know, I played in California All-State concert band because they didn't have an All-State jazz band at that time.
Right, right. Yeah, that took a minute. Yep.
And yeah, this was around 65, 66 in there. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated from high school in 66. And I went to Sacramento State for a couple of years. First year I played football. That's how I got in the school.
Really?
There.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a requirement.
Really good wide receiver.
I didn't have the speed, the sprint speed to make a career out of it. Mm. You know, I had decent hands. If the ball come near me, I could catch it, but I didn't have that kind of speed. You need to be almost a sprinter.
Right. Yeah, those long
to make
long
a career
shots.
Out of it.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's tough, man.
Yeah. So anyway, but I did that to fulfill my obligation, and I changed to a music major after the first year. And then I transferred. The school didn't offer a jazz degree, and I really wanted to play jazz. For lack of a better word to what we call this music.
Right.
Yeah. And I transferred to North Texas because they, offered a degree in jazz and they had a reputation.
We've talked about that because I had you come out there once or twice. Yeah. I think. Yeah. Yep.
And I did a year there. And then I just left school and started playing professionally.
Right.
I went back to the Bay Area, and in the Bay Area, I worked with Van Morrison. I worked. If you see a picture of me playing with him on my website, if you're interested,
I
did some recordings, Caravanserai with Santana. Later on, I played on Supernatural with Santana as well.
Oh, man.
You know, it's funny. I played on Supernatural. I played on the Miseducation, the Lauryn Hill recording that won all those Grammys. I played on Mariah Carey Unplugged, which won a Grammy. But I'm not going to say that I won a Grammy. People do that, you know. They say, won Grammys. I won 3 Grammys. No, you didn't. Mariah Carey and Santana and Lauryn Hill won the Grammys. But, you know.
Yeah, you want to claim it when you're the leader or the.
Yeah,
or
man. You know, it's my deal. So, anyway. But it was great to play on them.
Oh, man. That's some great cats. Did you get to hang much with Santana, with Carlos?
Not a lot.
Kind of private.
No, we were add-ons. Tom Harrell was in the horn section for that recording as well. Caravanserai. He didn't have a full horn section at that time, but he had it on the record for a couple of tunes.
Well, how did the Ray Charles hookup happen then?
Well, I was in the Bay Area, and actually, I heard that there was an opening, and I went down to LA and auditioned. And Ray liked the way I played, and he offered me the job, but he said, well, actually, we need a trombone, but we need a fourth trombone. We already have the first 3 chairs filled. You play bass trombone. And I had a large bore tenor with a F attachment at the time.
Right.
And there was nothing in the book that went below a pedal B flat. No low B naturals.
Right.
I got one. And I went and played the book on that horn for a year, but I also brought my tenor horn to play solos on.
Nice.
There's a video on YouTube of me playing with Ray's band.
I got a solo.
It's called Ray Charles. It's Copenhagen.
Oh, okay.
Black and white video live concert. And I stayed with Ray for the full year, and that was my first time to Europe in 72.
Wow.
We went, you know, all over the United States and Canada and everything. Ray had his own airplane. I mean, he was way ahead of the curve.
Right.
He had his own recording studio, publishing company, record label, management, booking agent. He was totally self-contained, had his own tour bus, his own airplane.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Well, he had been consummate. He had been, yeah, businessman and musical brilliance all together.
What was it? I just saw a thing. Bill Murray was given an interview, and they asked him, you know, what was your highlight of being in SNL? He goes, oh, without a doubt, Ray Charles. Just forget it. I shouldn't even been on the stage with him. You know, he just went on and on, said that he played in 5 or 6 different environments, just killed it. He, you know, was great in all the sketches they did. And what a talented cat, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, you've been, you know, famously with so many of the great guys. I wanted to try to catch a couple of them and then just focus on you because you're a great guy. But, you know, the cats that you've been with, your mentors and stuff, tell me about, I wasn't familiar with this. I knew that you were with Woody and then that you're with Blakey, but I didn't know that Woody got you into Blakey's band. I read that somewhere.
Yeah, let's, for the real jazz. And I say that with meaning, real jazz, as opposed to smooth jazz or the commercial aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But the art form, which is always what excited me.
Right. Yeah.
You know, as I had mentioned earlier, when I was in middle school, I started playing in the New Orleans style. And my see, my mom and dad, they were big band people, and they liked Louis Armstrong, and they liked big bands. They never got into Charlie Parker and the bebop. That was the next generation after them. They never got into this. So we used to hear, growing up around the house, they had recordings, you know, a record player and all that. And we heard big bands, and we heard Louis Armstrong. Ah. But in high school, someone gave me a J.J. Johnson record toward the end of high school. I think my senior year. And I didn't even know you could play it. I didn't know you could play trombone like that.
Right. That's the template right there, man.
And that turned me around. I wanted to play like that.
Yep.
So I got started getting all these records and trying to play along with them and stuff. It wasn't no real book. Some you had to learn stuff by ear.
See, that's better, man. That's 10 years later, and my generation was scarred by the real book, you know, reading instead of playing by ear. So that was...
Well, you know, the way I tell you this about the reading thing, it enables you to get to the stuff faster.
Well, yeah, I think you got to do both.
Yeah. If you got original music. I know when I was with Rahsaan, he's blind. We didn't have music, but Ray Charles is blind and he had music and he knew what written music was because we'd be playing at rehearsal and he'd stop a chart in the middle of the chart. He'd stop everybody and say, third trumpet on the third bar, let it be. You got an F or an F sharp.
Wow.
And the guy look at the part and say, F sharp. He said, well, son, play the F sharp then, damn it.
Yes, I heard he could be a little exacting with what he wanted.
Well, the thing is, I mean, if it's an F sharp, it's an F sharp.
Right, right. You gotta you know, play the right stuff.
And if you play it, it sounds great. People get mad, but I want to play it the way I want to play it. And he said, no. But if you play it the way he wants it, that's Ray Charles music. It's his band. Right. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a problem with that.
Sure.
I learned so much by giving him what he wanted because then I could get inside the feeling of where he was coming from.
Wow. What a gift that was. Yeah.
That's how you grow by becoming one with the people that you're playing with. You know, same with Rahsaan. I played with Rahsaan my first year of college.
Wow. Freshman in college playing with Rahsaan Roland.
Yeah, I was sitting in. Wow. I didn't get paid. But then after that, when I lived in San Francisco in the late 60s, I did work with him when he come through town and get paid.
Wow.
And then after Ray, I went back to the Bay Area. And that's when I met Woody Shaw. Mm. And Woody introduced me to Art Blakey. And I sat in and Art asked me to join the band. And he brought me to New York. Mm. And he looked out for me. I stayed with his apartment for a couple of weeks until I found a place to stay.
Wow.
And then Oh man, I worked with Art about 6 months, but the trombone was the extra horn.
Right.
The regular touring band was trumpet and sax. Mm-hmm. And if he get a gig that had more money, then he'd add me. Yeah. And so I went with Thad Jones, Mel Lewis Orchestra, and John Faddis introduced me because, he's from the Bay Area.
Sure.
Yeah. And I sat in with them and did a European tour and a West Coast tour, Monterey Jazz Festival, all that.
And as an aside, you just came back from a trip in that area playing with,
yeah,
with John.
Yeah, I did. I just did a gig in Oakland with John, too. Quintet
Man.
Gig with John.
We were talking last night. I think, John is one of my favorite musicians just across the board. Unbelievable brass artist, incredible lead player, wonderful jazz player. He's just one of my favorites. I love his sound. He's a nut. I can't imagine hanging out with him. It's got to be a blast. Never know what you're gonna get.
Yeah, I known him from way back, but
that must have been wonderful.
I don't feel he's gotten his due.
Nope.
You know,
I agree, man. He needs to be. How many cats can sound like Dizzy and himself? I mean, he's got his own sound, but you can tell if he wants to, he could sound exactly like Dizzy. I mean, there's not many cats that can pull that off.
He could play like Sweets. He could play like the real innovator of the trumpet with the name Roy is Roy Eldridge.
Oh,
he's
boy.
Because between Louis Armstrong and Dizzy, innovators both is Roy Eldridge, mm-hmm. who kind of had an in-between style.
Right, right.
And then, after Dizzy come Miles, and then of course Clifford, and then Freddie and Lee, and then Woody. That's innovative. Innovators mean that you create a new language for the instrument. Not there's a difference between being a master and a great player, a real master of the music and a master of the instrument, and being an innovator. An innovator means right. You create a different language, so to speak.
Well, man, those cats sure did. I think the first time I met you was with Woody Shaw. I think you guys were at the Blackstone Hotel where the jazz used to be. And I hadn't met you yet, and I was like just a beeline. I says, must meet Steve Touré. And you were very gracious and said hello. And that was, and that language with Woody. Whoo!
Yeah.
Man, more cats should, that's another guy that deserves a little more due, I think. I mean,
Well, the reason that people don't get into him so much, and it's same with Dizzy, is because they can't get to that stuff. It's so, I don't know. It's like impossible. He showed me what he was doing, but I can't play like that on a trombone. Man.
Oh, it's.
I haven't figured it out yet because he's so fluid with the intervals.
Right. I hear him in your playing. Every once in a while, you'll go angular, and you start doing some big intervals in an angular fashion. And I said,
Yeah. Well, that's his influence for sure. But I do it more in a melodic sense because he did
crazy stuff.
He could do
right.
it that fast,
I love me some Woody, man. That must have been so inspirational.
During the time with Woody is when I found my own voice.
Mm.
And he encouraged it, which is a wonderful thing.
Wow.
To be in that environment where you're allowed to search.
Mm-hmm.
And, sometime I'd play something that I didn't feel so good about. And then he'd come over, but the Mogul Miller would be playing a piano solo.
Right.
He'd say, man, what was that stuff you played on coming out the bridge on your second course? This is on the Moon Train,
Yeah. Yep.
And I said, oh, man, I'm sorry about that. I was just trying something, He said, no, that's cool. I never heard anybody go for that kind of sound on trombone. Keep doing it. You'll figure it out. Just land on your feet. Whatever you do, resolve it.
Mm. Oh, there it is. Yep. Wow.
You know, but go for it. You know, yep. He give me that freedom. And of course, I guess I thinking back on it, I guess it's because he have to have a certain amount of trust in you musically to give you that freedom.
Right. Yeah. A lot of respect and trust right there.
Yeah, because I know I've played with people, and if you tell them to play what they do, all of a sudden they're not in the same mind headspace as the rest of the band, or they're not in the rhythmic groove or harmonic groove of whatever it may be, whether it's free or not. It's like trying to put a square peg in a round hole.
Right.
But
right.
You know, he knew I was going for what the concept was of what the band was about.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's important. You know what, all the different bands I played with, different styles of jazz, Latin music. Mm-hmm. I put a whole different attack on the horn when I'm playing with Manny Oquendo or Tito Puente or than I do if I'm playing with Benny Golson.
Well, I think it's your respect for the music ultimately. You know, you're in there and you know what the music's about and what you want to bring to that style, to that person's music. You know, I'm sure that's why so many cats want you in their groups on their recordings.
Well, I've found it by putting my mind and spirit in the space of the collective. It's this music at its root is a collective music. It's not about me. It's about us.
Right. The ultimate collective conversation.
Yeah, because the best bands are a collective effort rather than individual effort.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is.
When you look at the Coltrane Quartet, Coltrane was the point of the spear, so to speak.
Right.
But that whole quartet, Miles's group with Wayne, Tony, Ron, and Herbie, my goodness, you know, I saw that band live.
Did you? Oh, that must have been a thrill.
I'm telling you,
yeah.
From having experienced it in person, that all these kids that think they're doing progressive stuff and you know, breaking new ground, man, they did. Miles did all that. That band did all that stuff for 50 years ago.
Right, early 60s. There's Wayne and Tony and Herbie and Ron and Miles.
But they took it even further. They took it even further live than they did on the records.
I'll bet they did. Wow.
You know.
Oh, that must have been cool. Well, you know, something that doesn't get discussed enough, I think, when, you know, people get together with you and interviews and stuff. I've as a trombone player, I've always admired your trombone playing, of course, but also I'm a big fan your abilities as a composer and arranger. And this should be discussed more often. I'd like to know a little bit of your development as a writer, maybe some influences, that sort of thing.
I don't know. I started writing little tunes in high school, I guess.
See, there it is. See, because I think you're very, not only just clever and gifted with, you know, how you do things, but it's always seems to me to be based on a melody. It's always very melodic, everything you write.
Well, my instrument, the trombone is really a melodic instrument.
Right.
Like a cello, you know, a melodic. I think the trombone sings melodically, you know, in a beautiful way.
And absolutely.
That's, you know, so I prefer to go that route. You know, I like to play fast too, but to play fast, you got to have a rhythm section that hears it the right way.
If it
sounds like a metronome where it's just chunk, 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 chunk fast.
Yeah.
I don't feel it because I'm hearing the wide beat.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, which means if you got a real fast tempo, like, you should be able to tap your foot. You should be able to tap your foot at a quarter time.
Right.
Like that.
Right.
And And the way a lot of people play it, it's just like one, 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 one. And it's
right, right.
If you play the slow beat, it don't fit.
Mm.
You know, it come out wrong if you play the slow beat. So that means that the fast beat is not steady.
Oh, I see.
Oh, it's what we call a wide beat.
Just a minute here. Here's my wife is here for a moment. What do you got? Yes. That's right. She says hello. Steve, this is Deborah.
Hello.
Deborah, this is Steve Touré right here.
Yeah,
we started a little late. Okay. Yeah. Oh, and now my golden retriever's coming in here, Phoebe. She's bringing me my socks for some reason.
Hey, look at that. Deborah and Phoebe coming by to visit Wheastworld. You know what? Let's just go ahead and take a break here. You got the break music, the groove in the background. And then we will get back to lots more about Steve Touré. But first, we're going to take a moment for this message from our one and only sponsor. And that sponsor is me. This has to do with a very cool, new, exciting social media platform that I've put together with my pal Michael Lake. We call this Jamtrek, J-A-M-T-R-E-K, Jamtrek. And it's a social media for creative folks. I like to think of it as of the cats, by the cats, and for the cats. Musicians, all other artists, content creators, creative folk, get together, discuss, hobnob, hang out, socialize. It is free of charge. There are no algorithms. It's a cyber party. And I'd like to see y'all go there and partake, post, comment, etc., etc. Let's get together. The address for this magnificent soiree is jam-trek.com. jam-trek.com. So I hope to see you all over there. Let's start up a discussion and have a great time. In the meantime, it's back to Steve Touré.
You know, I learned to read and write music in school. And in the European side of things, like how to follow a conductor and how to blend in a section and how playing lead is different than playing in the section. And you got to follow the lead player's phrasing and all those are the European side of things. Mm-hmm. But the real core of the music is the African side of the music. And if without that, it's not jazz, in my opinion.
Oh, I agree with you on that, I think.
And it's really the African concept of rhythm that distinguishes a lot of the straight eighth stuff today that we hear is amazing technically and interesting too intellectually.
Right, right.
You know, but it doesn't have the blues and it doesn't have any African rhythmal concept in it. It's almost, yep. You know, and to me, what defines jazz from other forms of improvised music, because there are many forms of improvised music on the planet,
right?
Is the blues number one, and which comes from the African concept of rhythm and all of that. And so, anyway, playing with Rahsaan at, I guess, age 18, that was my real introduction to heavyweight. I mean, I was aware of it and had the records and would go hear people live, but the participatory aspect.
On the bandstand with him.
Yeah, that was my really first introduction to playing with people on that level.
Sure.
And, you know, after I came to New York with Art and everything, I went with Thad and Mel. We mentioned that.
Yeah, and that must have been fun.
Oh, big! That's the best big band I ever played with. My goodness!
Yeah, that's especially of that era. That was just forget about it, man.
John was playing lead trumpet.
Woo.
And let's see, Jimmy Nepper was playing first trombone.
I thought that he was in that one, yeah.
Quint and Jimmy was incredible, man. He really had the Charlie Parker language down. I don't think a lot of the younger players don't know about him that much. And he
that's
was
a shame. He's tough so customer, heavy, man. Yeah. I think wasn't Butter in the section at that point as well.
Well, I'm gonna get to that.
All right, all right.
But that tenure with Thad and Mel for really less than a year had a profound influence on me in my development, because Jimmy had a house in Staten Island and I used to drive over there. So I drove a car from California to New York. So I had a car and I drive over and practice with him. And he really turned me on to alternate positions.
Wow.
You know, things like playing E flat minor 7. After the E flat ascending, you go to fifth position and just stay there. Instead of 1-5, a 1-5, no, excuse me, 3-5-1-2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's awkward, E flat minor 7 ascending. But if you go
3-5,
you can do it fast and it lays and boodle-a-day, you know, like that.
So try he was getting into that. All that with you.
Try doing that with what they call home positions. You know, it don't work.
Yeah, it'll break your arm right there, man.
It's
much hipper in fifth position. I agree.
So he got me going with that.
Wow.
Then I sat next to Quentin Jackson, and he showed me the plunger stuff, especially with the Pixie. And I've gone on almost all of my records, I always have something with the plunger, because that's an important part of the language of the trombone and the music.
I was going to ask you about some of that when we get to the lightning rod stuff. It's very
and
vocal.
I know when he first came to New York, Wynton called me up and sent him over here, and I showed him how to work the plunger, because Wynton told me he doesn't know anything about the plunger. We're going to do Duke Ellington. This is in the 90s, you know.
Right. Oh, Wycliffe, you're hipping him to the...
Yeah, I showed him about the plunger, and I told him, I can play open horn, but my expertise is with the Pixie. And so I showed him that, and what I did is I gave him Al Gray's number for the open horn, because Al is the boss for the open horn. And he went over and saw Al Gray as well. And in my humble opinion, he's the leading voice on the plunger out there today. He's incredible with the plunger, man.
Talking about Wycliffe or Al?
Wycliffe. Al's gone.
I know, yeah. But he was the cat, but yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I would agree with you, man. Wycliffe is doing phenomenal stuff now.
With the plunger, you know, with the early music sound, New Orleans and Ellington and whatnot.
Right.
He's really carrying that forward. And then after Thad and Mel, I did a week with Chico Hamilton.
Uh-oh.
And as a quintet with trombone and saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me up for the next weekend's gig, and he was freaking out. He said, man, my bass player pulled out on me, and he went with Horace Silverspan, and we don't have a bass player for the gig this weekend. And I called everybody I know. No, do you know any bass players? And I called around, and I called him back, said, no, I don't know anybody available. And so I told him I play electric bass, because, you know, I used to play electric bass in high school, and I played it in North Texas too. And
I didn't know that. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they would never let me in the 1 o'clock band, because I wouldn't cut my hair.
Uh-oh.
Because I got long, you know, I got that long braid. But I played 3 semesters there. I played first trombone 1 semester in the 2 o'clock. another semester, I played bass trombone at 2 o'clock. And another semester, I played bass in the 2 o'clock.
Wow.
And I every semester I was playing in three bands a day. So it was great. Yeah. You know, it was good playing. Got a lot of playing in.
Yeah, and it's a good workout, man.
You know what I really got out of North Texas was every day they had this big library and they'd put up one or two new charts you've never seen before and give you 2 or 3 minutes to look it over and count it off, sink or swim.
Yep. Oh, it's good for getting the sight reading together. Holy cow.
Yeah, man. It taught me not to be scared of a piece of music. And when you get a new piece of music, scan it and go right to the part that looks hard and figure that out.
Right, right.
With Chico, I ended up playing bass with him because I played that weekend. And he said, well, I like the way you play bass, man. You want to play bass in a band, I'll give you a good raise. He almost doubled my salary, said stay on the bass.
Wow.
So for almost 2 years I did that, but I really wanted to play the trombone. He said, well, you could play trombone too. Yeah. And what that meant was once a night he'd go get a drink at the bar and play a ballad with the guitar duet.
Oh, right.
After a couple of years of that, I got tired of that.
Yeah.
And then Rasan called me to join his band, and I went back with him full-time touring and all that stuff. And then Rasan passed away, and I was in New York. Rasan was one of the few artists that I've ever worked for that took out unemployment and did the tax thing, all that withholding. So when he passed away, I was able to get unemployment for a couple of years, and that really helped me survive New York rents.
Yep.
And I ended up playing with Slide Hampton, took over a big band called Creative Black Artists. And I did that for a couple of years, and every month he'd write arrangements and do a concert featuring luminaries of the time, Ron Carter, Pharoah Saunders, people like that.
Wow. Was that when you did one of those World of Trombone tours?
Well, yes, during that period.
Yeah.
And also I started working with Cedar Walton and recording with him in the quintet format for the Columbia Records, Animation and Soundscapes.
Man, that must have been fun. He's just one of my favorite composers and artists. Just what a sound the way he writes, man. I just love it.
And also during that period leading up to when I joined Woody in the early 80s, I also worked with Pharoah Saunders and Archie Shepp and Lester Bowie and James Newton.
Man,
it gets to be a blur. I was working a lot on the Latin scene too. They had a thing at the Village Gate called Salsa Meets Jazz. During the mid to late 80s. And every Monday night, they'd have named salsa bands, you know, Ruben Blades, Tito Puente, Eddie Palmieri, El Gran Combo, Oscar de Leon, Celia Cruz, all these different artists. Yeah. And they'd have a guest jazz soloist. So I got to do a lot of those and play with some wonderful bands. Hector Laveau, boy, I'll never forget that. Yeah. What a voice.
That's got to be a blast. I mean, just, you know, playing that style of jazz and just being in the midst of the salsa rhythm section and all that. Man.
No rehearsal. They just play a Montuno and you just go for it.
Right.
And it was great. That's when I met Stanley Turrentine. I ended up working with him too.
Man, so many cats. You just were a part of the current of the music, man. And we're just out there with the guys.
Yeah. And then McCoy started his big band and we did a record live at the Blue Note. And he also recorded some of my compositions on his big band records.
Oh, that's cool. Did you do the big band orchestrations?
I did, yeah, the whole charts, everything.
Man,
you know,
that's killing.
Original tunes, you know, sure. He won original tunes. And
Right.
You know, it was wonderful.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of those records, man. What a great, great sound that was.
Yeah, yeah, that modal thing, man.
Yep.
And you know, to me, McCoy's music was very spiritual, man.
Mm-hmm.
He had so much chops that it wasn't, it like Bird, it wasn't about the chops.
Right.
It wasn't about, it was about the feeling.
Yep.
And when he played fast, it didn't sound or feel like he played fast. It was just an expression.
Man, it's key, isn't it? You know, whether we're talking about swing or melody or whatever, man, it's the feeling. It's the sense of the, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. soul of the music.
Yeah.
Man, so it must have been right around this time that you you hooked up with the SNL gig, too.
Well, that was after Woody. I played with Woody's band for 3 years full time. I had started recording with him right after I came to New York with Art Blakey on. Mm. First record was The Moon Train.
Yep. Yeah.
On Muse. And that was my first composition recorded as well, Sanyas.
Wow.
And my first solo on record also on that.
Man.
And interestingly, Sanyas, I re-recorded it, and it's a title cut on my latest live recording. My first live recording at 76 years old.
Whoa! So you've got a recording that's newer than Generations?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's called Sanyas.
Yeah. It's called Sanyas. Oh, I miss that one, man. I will. All right, everybody listening, purchase this recording. Don't just go listen to it. Go out and buy it. You can get, you know, if you only like downloads, get it on Amazon MP3 or something, man. Just buy the album. But Sanyas, I'm going to get it. So I don't have that for the lightning round, but I'll...
And it's a sextet with, front line is trumpet, Nicholas Payton and Ron Blake on sax.
Wow.
Rhythm section is Buster Williams on bass, Lenny White on drums, and a young, phenomenal young piano player named Isaiah Thompson.
Wow. Man, that sounds fun. And it's live.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's Smoke. On the Smoke Sessions label.
I will check that out, man.
Yeah. Anyway, after Woody the band broke up, and Woody went to Europe for a while. And that's when I started doing SNL. Mm. And at the same time, that's when I started working with Dizzy.
Oh, okay, you know? Right.
And, you know, with SNL, you can take off.
Oh, that's cool.
But, you know, union rules say half the time, but I never took off half the time because I didn't want to abuse it and mess up the gig. But I'd take off to work with Dizzy or take off to work with McCoy or take off to work with Cedar Walton or Lester Bowie.
Mm.
You know, and gigs where I'm going to not just get paid well, but learn something.
Man, we'll talk about being around a mentor. That Dizzy is just the ultimate
mentor, you ain't kidding,
patriarch.
Man.
Something I heard him say once we were talking earlier about, you were talking about the blues and stuff. And there's a great video. I've heard him say this in person too, but a video where somebody... Some interviewer is saying, so are the blues important to jazz? It was one of those interview silly questions, you know, are the blues important? Dizzy said, well, if it doesn't have the blues in it some kind of way, I don't think it is jazz anymore. And I thought, well, there's Dizzy.
Yeah. Well, I feel the same way.
Yeah, me too, man. And you can hear it, you know, you can hear it in all the cats, no matter how heavy it gets. If they're happening and swinging, it's the blues are in there.
Yeah. So during that time, you know, I was working with Dizzy and Lester and McCoy and SNL and Cedar. And then and I started recording my first record as a leader was 86. I recorded, I think, late 86 or it came out in 87. And then 88 was my second one. And they've just been reissued digitally.
Oh, man. Cool.
On European Gramophone. It's Christian Lindbergh's label. We met and he talked to me and said, you got something you want to put out? And I said, well, I own my first two records.
And so he put them out. So they're available again. So everybody know that.
And what's the label? What's his label called?
European Gramophone.
European Gramophone. All right.
Yeah. And the first album, my very first record, is called Viewpoint. Mm. And the second record is called Fire and Ice.
Is one of those got your one of the first times you did Lament in Three? Because I remember you.
That's it, the Viewpoint record.
Yeah, I remember hearing that, and it was like, whoa, that's perfect. I mean, it really lends itself to 3/4. You know, who would know? But man, oh man, so
when I started recording. In the 90s, I got signed to Verve, and I did those records with the Shell Choir.
Yep. Sanctified and stuff. And
yeah, Rhythm Within, I think, is my favorite. I got to say I like them all for different reasons.
Sure.
Dizzy's on the first one. And the second one, Rhythm Within, Herbie is on, Herbie Hancock and Pharoah Saunders and John Faddis. And on the third one, Steve Touré, JJ's on it.
Yeah.
And who else? So Cassandra Wilson and Graciela, that's Machito's sister. She sang a bolero that's really wonderful.
Wow. Man. And
then we in the 2000s, and I just keep rolling, you know.
How many you think you got as a leader now? I was trying to figure that out.
20, about 20.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I'm not in a hurry to, you know, flood the market, so to speak, but I have a lot of dream projects I'd still like to do.
Absolutely.
But I know, you know, to me, I would like to be able to afford to do my own records and do them right. See, I don't want to do them unless I can do it right.
Absolutely.
Which means not only pay the studio time and pay for the time to get a good mix, because that can make or break a recording, even if you have a good performance. If the mix isn't good, they can make a trombone sound tinny and horrible.
I'm hip, man. And through that recently.
Oof. Yeah. And anyway, not just the mix and the studio time, pay the musicians properly.
Yep.
And then get it distributed and all that properly too, you know. And so all my records have been from record companies.
Right.
But record companies also have another connections, because that's their business. Their business is not making music. That's our business.
Right.
Their business is getting the music out there.
Mm-hmm. Which, so that's a whole nother, that'd have to be a whole nother show, can of worms,
exactly.
Music business.
Woo! Yeah, man.
That's some crazy. Well, you know what? Let's keep her moving here.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to get to, and, you know, like I said, add anything, anytime. You know, I've just got my little list here. But let's talk, if you want to get into this at all, since there'll be some trombone students checking this out. What is there like a Steve Touré daily regime or daily kind of workout that you try to do on the horn these days?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is, what's your scene with that?
Well, I'll tell you my routine, but it varies depending on how my body feels.
Right.
Now, you know, I'm fine. I'm 76 now. I'm finding as the years go by, the older I get, the more I have to warm up.
Yeah, same here.
I mean, my flexibility doesn't start to come together till after I played a couple of hours anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm right there with you, and I'm 9 years younger, but it gets tough.
But let's say on your typical day, I'll play some long tones, starting in the middle F, right in a staff, not loud, and just full resonance without pushing. And if the sound is open, you know, I might go down each note at full breath, as long as you can hold it without straining, just natural.
Yeah.
Down the low F and then from the middle F up to high F. But sometimes I can tell my sound is already open. And other times I got to do that two or three times to get it to open up some. You know, just my body, different days.
Sure.
The horn is the same.
Yeah. Do you remember that thing? I keep thinking of Dizzy. Remember that bit he would do? He'd talk about some days you take the horn out of the case and the horn wins.
Right. Yeah.
Some days you take the horn out of the case and you win, and then then you die and the horn wins.
Well, then after I do some long tones to get my sound to vibrate, then I'll do flexibilities. And I found that the flexibility from the middle F down to low F and then up to the B flat above that, like a ba di da da, or the other way, da 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 di.
Mm-hmm.
If I get that to really flow on the same airstream, then all the way down the seventh position, the low E.
Yeah.
Then I'll open up the range. But that register to me is the key.
Right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, right there in the middle and low.
Yeah. And people, you notice that 90% of jazz trombonists don't go below that middle F. They avoid the low register.
Right. I do notice that. I mean, there's some cats, it's very stark. That's 'cause
it's hard.
It is.
It's hard, man. It's hard to get a full sound down there compared to up higher, you know.
Right. And I noticed that you spend a lot of time down there on your solos, and I think that's a rich part of the horn, man. It's one of the things you do that I like.
You know who really utilizes the low register well on his solos, and he has a trigger too, but Robin Eubanks is really
he's crazy on that stuff. Yeah, he is.
Yeah, man.
He is crazy on that.
Yeah.
Man, oh man. What a hang, huh? What a session. Steve Turay. So that's part one. We got into so much stuff. I'm going to divide this episode up into two parts. So that's the end of part one. Part two will be the lightning round. All right. We'll see y'all next time. Bye.
WCBC Westward.